Okay, so we good morning. We can probably start now. I took a look of your activity tree in the database. Thank you. You are actually moving on quite fast. So there are many items inside. Good. And the other story is that I opened another activity that just few questions on the Redis paper we read yesterday. So just to fix some concept in your mind. Okay. So the story is that we can start with the lesson today. So what we do today actually is something a little bit probably boring. I'm sorry for you. But we have to revise descriptive story on chromatin structures, and so it makes a lot of both methodological and biochemical stories. So be patient. We will start with more interesting things next week. Today in the afternoon we will also find the next paper, which is for the next week. So it's not open yet, so I will open in the afternoon. So chromatin structure, and this small symbol here means euchromatin versus heterochromatin. Simply we going through the structures of chromatin and try to see what the difference are in the two, let's say, the two completely different structures. But of course, as always in biology, you will never have an on-off, okay? So we are humans, so we like to make categories, and we talk about euchromatin and heterochromatin, but actually the in between, we have all the middle situations that are in between the two, okay? Anyway, it's useful to make a category for some classification in our mind. So this is what a common book show, right? Probably you saw already something similar to it. And this is a kind of reductionist view of chromatin, in the sense that actually you never see a chromatin like this. This is due to modeling of what you see at the electron microscope when you try to extract chromatin. Okay, so when you extract chromatin in making a medium salt solution, so a middle ionic strength solution, what happens is that you remove all the proteins that are non-histone. Histones are so basic. They have many, many positive charges, okay? So they really stick to the DNA. And to remove histones from DNA, you need really high ionic strengths, okay? So if you make a middle ionic strength, you will remove only the proteins that are weakly bound to the chromatin, okay? And what they used to do in the past was to make extraction in middle ionic strength, and so you will find what people call it the 30 nanometers fiber, that is this guy here. Okay, so in this kind of structure, you just have nucleosomes that are wrapped around an ideal axis, making six nucleosome turns like this. Okay, maybe this is the picture of it. Okay. Actually, today we think that it's a little different. It's something like this one. But anyway, what you see in the axis is the same. Okay? But this is a completely artificial situation, I mean, because you never have in vivo, you never have a situation in which there is pure DNA and pure nucleosomes. Never. You always have other proteins attached to it. Okay? So it's much more real to see something like this one, which, as you can see, you have both nucleosomes. The yellow things are nucleosomes, right, with the two thirds of DNA around, and you have many other proteins, transcription factors, or just ATP remodeling complexes like this one, or any other chromatin assistant, let's say, so enzymes that actually help the metabolism of chromatin, okay? So it's a kind of mix, it's never really pure histones and DNA, okay? So there is one additional story, that is H1, histone 1, you probably heard about it. Actually, it's not a component of the core nucleosome, but it's lateral, okay? And it actually, when you remove histone 1, like in this figure, if you remove it, it is usually loosely bound to the nucleosome like this, in this figure, and actually helps keeping the two emerging DNA together, okay? So if you remove the H1, the two DNA open up like this, okay? And so you find this kind of structure. No histone 1 plus histone 1, okay? So if you remove from this story, you increase a little bit the ionic strength, the H1 will go away, and you get this pearls on a string structure. Okay? That is classical book. Again, you never see this kind of structure in vivo. Okay? Good, so we have this kind of story, and actually this has been modeled in the chemical structure with enormous work that was made in, let's say, 15 years ago. The structuralists make crystals of all the parts of this structure and then try to model it, okay? And as you probably remember, you have seen the structure of the nucleosome here. You can see the two turns of DNA around, and then you have the core histones there, okay? So all the nucleosomes are like this one. And so if you can just make a scheme out of it, you have this core octamer inside here. It takes about 146 base pair of DNA in contact with DNA. Okay, and then you have a linker DNA that is variable, something to 20 from 60. Also, in some cases, you have more longer linkers inside, depending on the functional status of the chromatin. And then this is the, let's say, the standard structure of the DNA. Okay? Another observation is that it's incredibly conserved. Histones are among the most conserved proteins ever. They change very, very little from yeast to man to human. And incredibly, the length of DNA around is always the same. So it's a very, very basic structure of DNA in eukaryotes. Okay. Great, this is that the four histones that you know. I mean, this is a kind of ripasso, resume of what you know already. But just to remember that the histones have a fold, and this fold that is here depicted is conserved in all the histones. Okay, all the histones make the same fold inside. Okay, and they share the same core structure, that is this helix. Okay, and they differ from the tails. The tails are a little different. Okay, please note that the N-terminal tail is the longest one. The C-terminus is shorter. And actually here you will see that we have the main highest number of post-transcriptional modifications are there in the N-terminus, the terminal tail, okay? So when you isolate histones from the cell, you also get dimers and tetramers that are probably an intermediate state of packing of the nucleus. Good, so you can in vitro to reconstruct nucleosomes, okay, and you have several steps in which you have H3 and A4 that mounts a tetramer, and then H2A, H2B makes a dimer, and then you can mount all together with the DNA. This is possible in vitro, okay, in the test tube. In vivo, actually, this construction, this building up of a nucleosome requires proteins that are actually chaperones, so they help the structure to be built. Okay, these tails are completely outside the structure of the nucleosome. And this, we know that since very long time, because if you make a protease treatment, you remove them. So they are accessible to protease. Okay. Core histones are not. They are more stable. Okay. Okay, so looking at the molecular organization of heterochromatin versus euchromatin, we have a number of features that distinguish them. The first is accessibility. Second, nucleosome positioning. Third, post-translational modification to histones that we call PTMs. Histone-binding proteins and modifying enzymes. Histone variants. Then something that is not in the core chromatin structure, that is DNA methylation, non-coding RNA and transcription factors. Okay, so let's take a look, and always remember that you have, when we talk about heterochromatin, we always have two kinds of heterochromatin, that is the facultative and constitutive. Constitutive heterochromatin is the one that you find in telomeres and centromeres that are always, always heterochromatic since the very early stage of development. Why? Can you associate something that we talked about yesterday with this notion? How is the DNA in centromeres and telomeres? Do you remember? How is the DNA sequence?
Repeats.
Okay. So whenever you have repeats, you have heterochromatin. We talked about it yesterday. Okay. So that's the reason. Okay. On the contrary, facultative heterochromatin is something that is established during development and differs from cell to cell. Okay. Good. Can we distinguish a condenser, so heterochromatic regions from euchromatic regions with a simple biochemical assay? The story is yes, and the principle is the enzyme accessibility. Of course, if you have a packet chromatin like the 30 nanometer structure that you saw before, it's difficult for an enzyme to go through. If you have open chromatin, it's easier. Okay, so a very ancient assay for chromatin that actually is better if we study, because it's a principle. Okay, is this DNA's one hypersensitivity assay. So people have been using this DNase 1, that is an Escherichia coli enzyme that you can purify easily from Escherichia coli. And when you take cells from your culture and treat with SDS, you get chromatins. Okay, I just used the simplest pages, but don't care. Then if you treat DNAs, what you get is this kind of chromatin will be digested much more than the other one, okay? And you get fragments. These are fragments of chromatin, okay? At this point, you can deproteinize these fragments of chromatin, okay? And you get DNA fragments, okay? These DNA fragments that can be further digested with the restriction enzyme that you choose for your particular experiment, okay? And at this point, you can analyze them in a gel electrophoresis. Okay, so you can evaluate the sizes of this. So just intuitively, if you have all the packet chromatin, you will get very large fragments because it's the DNA is not accessed to it, okay? If you have open chromatin, you probably get smaller fragments over there, okay? So you, this point, you just blot. You know what is southern blotting? You know. Okay, so just blotting on the nitrocellulose paper or something, and then you can probe with a radioactive probe to see your gene. Where is your gene? Okay, you have a probe, you see your gene there. So if the region where your gene is inaccessible, so packet heterochromatic, you will find mostly very high molecular weight bands. If the region where your gene is open, so euchromatic, okay, this will be cut in small pieces and you find mostly smaller bands, okay? Good. Let me show you an experiment so you see in real life what it means, okay? I took fibroblasts and keratinocytes. Fibroblasts are mesenchymal cells, okay, and keratinocytes are epidermal cells, okay? So if I look at the keratin K14, this is just one of the many keratin genes that are in our genus. This is K14, but anyway, it's a keratin gene, so it expresses keratin. We will think that probably it is expressed in keratinocytes, as the name says, and probably is not expressed in fibroblasts. Do you agree with that? Okay, good. So we are trying to see whether this expression yes, expression not, corresponds to chromatic statuses. Okay? So if you have heterochromatic status in fibroblasts, you will be not accessible to DNAs. If you have euchromatic status here, it will be accessible. So I take exactly what I said before. Okay? This is just a region of the gene or the locus. This is the transcriptional start site, so the coding sequence is down here, okay? Okay? And here is the promoter, probably, and this is probably a region that controls, as you know, the expression of those genes, enhancers or whatever. Look at the fragment. This is minus 5,700, okay? So you are there, and this is plus 1,100. So it's a... All the fragment is 6.8 or something, okay? Now, I make what I told you. So I take fibroblasts and keratinocytes separately, of course. They make chromatin preparation, then digest it with DNAs. Then I digest with one of these orienting enzymes, because otherwise I have fragments everywhere. I cannot understand everything. So I just cut with orienting restriction enzyme, okay? So, and then I run on a gel, and then I stain with a probe. The probe is here. So I use this terminal probe, okay? In the very last region here on the left, okay? So what I see here is that, okay? This is just increasing amount of DNAs. Since I don't know, at the very beginning of the experiment, I don't know what is the accessibility, okay? So we use usually different concentration, okay? So a little bit more, this. And I look for what happens in my southern blot. As you can see here, in fibroblast, there is only one band, even at a very high concentration of DNAs, I only get this band. Look at the size. This is 6.8. It's exactly all the fragment from here to here. 6.8, right? So it means that all this fragment of DNA has not been attached by DNAs. Okay? So the enzyme couldn't reach any place. Consequently, we say this is heterochromatic. Okay? Look at what happens with keratinocytes instead. Keratinocytes, when I increase the concentration of DNAs, another band appears, then another band here, and another band here. This means that other sites in this fragment will become accessible. Okay, I can measure them. I can measure the size of these fragments, and I can derive, since my probe is there, I just look at fragments starting from here. Okay, so I can evaluate that this fragment, the shorter one, is there. This is hypersensitive site. This HSS means hypersensitive site. Okay, then the second fragment here is this one. The other one here is this one, and the other one here is this one. Okay? Clear? What is this? Why I can get a hypersensitive site from this region? Well, this is the promoter. Of course, if the gene is transcribed, the promoter is open. No nucleosome on it, okay? Forcibly. The DNase 1 accessibility corresponds to the polymerase 2 accessibility, okay? It's the same. Good. And what are they? What are they? These are probably enhancers. We don't know from this figure, but they are probably enhancers. Again, the regions in which we have different proteins binding to it, and they are open a little bit. And so DNS can reach and digest, okay? So this is a very classical, as you can see, this is an older work, 20 years ago, but this defines enhancers. So in that period of time, 20 years ago, we were defining enhancers and promoters this way. I'm making DNAs, hypersensitive studies, and say, okay, this is accessible, so it will be an answer there, blah, blah, blah. And then this is an active promoter, okay? Good, this is only done with another enzyme, so it's the same situation with another enzyme, okay? Good. Okay, so you have differential sensitivity of this DNA's assay all through the genome. Okay, and of course this can also depend not only from the status of activity of the gene, but also from the distribution of nucleosomes. Okay, so we have questions that are quite relevant to the genome organization. Is first, do nucleosomes display preferred positions on the genome? Second, do nucleosomes display any kind of specificity for sequence? This is another good point. Third, are nucleosomes mobile? So do they move? Or are they stay just gripped on the DNA in the same place forever? So they can translate position in DNA or not? And finally, is nucleosome position functional to gene or genome regulation? I mean, when you have special position, it will be something that is, for example, is useful to transcribe or useful to repress, okay? So, nucleosomes are usually, there are different stories, because one is the so-called passive positioning. That means that whenever you have a nucleosome with a DNA that you make in vitro, okay, there is a kind of passive position in the sense that the nucleosome likes more some sequence than other ones. And this actually is due to the fact that the DNA, we usually depict DNA like a very straight axis like this, okay? But this is the theoretical situation. Actually, whenever you have short stretches of A and T, adenine and thymine, the axis is not right, is not straight, but it's a little bent, okay? It makes a curve. And so, of course, since nucleosome has to bend a little bit the DNA, if DNA is already bent, it prefers to sit there. Okay, that's a kind of passive position. So just remember that the protein DNA contacts are mainly due to basic amino acids through backbone phosphate. Okay, so there is no really specificity. When you look at the nucleosomes binding to the DNA, you never see contact with the base pairs. So this means that there is no specificity for the base pairs. Okay. You probably remember some other situation, we will see it, but when you look at that transcription factor binding to DNA, you remember there is a tight interaction of the transcription factor in the major group, and inside it looks for the bases. Okay. Instead here you never see that situation. So there is no specificity on structural bases. Okay. Then, if you look at this on average, so if you look at the average of all the nucleosomes through the DNA, you discover that usually GC-rich regions position out of the nucleosome, while AT-rich region position close to the DNA. And this is due to what I told you before. So AT stretch are bent already. Okay? So this is a... But this is average, it's not the reality, it's average, okay? Good, and the other story is if we ask it whether the nucleosome is fixed or not. So there are a lot of experiments made years before in which people try to address the story, and the usual way was this one. You take a DNA piece in your test tube, okay, and this is DNA. You put a transcription factor binding site and a restriction enzyme site, okay? Then you try to assemble a nucleosome always in your test tube, okay? So the nucleosome can go wherever, okay? Assembles more or less wherever in this fragment of DNA. And the fact that is wherever, you know, because you use restriction enzyme. So if the nucleosome sits on the restriction enzyme site, it won't cut, okay? If it is here, it will cut. So when you make this kind of experiments, you will see that half of the, more or less half, I mean, a part of your DNA is cut and the other part is not. So it's a kind of average. You can have nucleus or whatever. Then you take this one, this situation, and add a transcription factor. So you, in your test tube, you add the protein transcription factor that will bind to this site. At this point, you make again the assay of restriction enzyme, and you don't cut anymore. So this means that all the nucleosomes that were here, they have been pushed to this place because of the transcription factor binding here. Okay. So this also means that the position of nucleosome is not fixed, but dynamic. Okay. Whenever they free the transcription factor, the transcription factor will bind to it and stop the reaction. Okay. So this is very, very clear. So, the take-home message is that actually you have a mobility of the nucleosomes, okay? For the nucleosome, it's probably the same from a thermodynamic point of view to be here, or here, or here. And so, it goes, okay? How it moves is quite easy to see, because actually you have two turns, and the nucleosome turns. So you have turning of the nucleosome, and so some DNA is free, and the other one is occupied. Okay, then there is an in vivo situation that is definitely more interesting, because this is just in the test tube. Of course, when you have test tube, it's an artificial situation. I mean, it tells you principles, but of course, if you can address the situation in vivo, it's better. And this is the Macrococcus nuclease digestion assay. It's quite similar to the DNAs that we saw before. But micrococcal nuclease has a little bit different activity than the other one. DNA is a big enzyme and has only endonuclease activity, okay? So it moves through the chromatin when it finds accessibility, makes a single cut in the linker, okay? That's it. Micrococcal nuclease is a smaller enzyme and has double activity. So it has both, is a mixed endo-exonuclease. It can both cut the DNA and trim it. Do you know what trimming is? You have endo DNA, you have exonuclease, digest one nucleotide at a time and then you remove it, okay? Exonuclease. Until, of course, reaching the nucleosome. My hand here is the nucleosome. This is the linker. I trim it. But when I arrive there, I cannot trim it any longer. Okay? So the overall effect of a micrococcal nuclease is to cut in the linkers and then digest all the linker and leave only the DNA that is around the nucleosome. Can you follow me? That is the famous 146 bases that we see before. Okay? Good. So, the experiment is quite simple. We take cells in culture, whatever, and we isolate the nuclei. You say, how to isolate the nuclei? It's not really difficult. You just make a hypotonic lysis of the cells. So you treat with a hypotonic solution. They will explode because they take water inside. They explode and then make a slow speed centrifugation. Nuclei will fall down. Okay, it's very easy. Then at this point you add MNAs, that is micrococcal nuclease, to the nuclei. I told you this enzyme is small. It can pass quite easily the nuclear pores, so it gets inside the nuclei. So the situation of the chromatin there is as it was in the cells. No modification, no extraction of the chromatin as before. Okay, and it will cut wherever it finds a linker. Okay. Then, as again, we have to reorient, okay, with the restriction enzyme to study a position, okay. And then we purify cut DNA and we study the situation. Now, the two final arrows there just illustrate to you two different situations, extreme situation, okay. Imagine to have nucleosome completely at random in a locus. Okay, so you have a locus that you are studying, like the keratinocyte promoter that we studied before. Okay, and nucleosome are exactly at random. They can be here in one cell, a little bit farther in another cell, a little farther in another one, and so random, okay? And then the completely opposite situation. So the nucleosomes are strictly positioned. For example, in the locus that we saw before, imagine that one nucleosome can sit down always at the promoter, okay? So fixed it there in all cells, okay? This is positioning. Now, look at what happens. So, just look at this, and this, change the slide, and see nucleosome at random, or positioned nucleosomes. So you see that here, what are all the lines are the situation in different cells, okay? Or each line is the chromosome in a different cell. And you see that here, the nucleosome are random position. In this case, on the other side, they are exactly the same position, all the alleles, okay? So when you cut here with the MNAs, you always get here, wherever you can reach it, okay? And then the MNAs trims the fragments, okay? And in this case, of course, it's a different situation because you have cuts wherever, okay? Random, okay? Then at this point, you gel you extract the DNA and you gel electrophorese it and then you solder blood it with a probe. And as usual, you use a probe that is end of your fragment. This is the probe, okay? So go there and see the results. So this is the mobile situation, so random positioning. You will get all the possible fragments all around, okay? Always consider that the probe is here, so you won't see any fragments starting from here to here, okay? So you just see the fragments starting from the right side and ending in the left, okay? Say that again? No. I have to say that again, or it's right? That's right, okay. So in the other situation, you only see fragments that start here and in this position, or in this position, or in this position, okay? I southern blot them, and I put the radioactive probe here, and I will see all the fragments here, only fixed fragments there, okay? So this tells me if nucleosomes are positioned or are not positioned, okay? We will see a real life example of it shortly. Just to answer into this story, is nucleosome positioning relevant to function? Okay. So we take an example here. This is a yeast. In yeast, we have a gene. This is 4. It's called 4-5. 4 stands for phosphate. It's a gene that encodes a protein for phosphate metabolism. Okay. The yeast is a simple guy, you know, it's not a complicated network of regulation. If you have lack of phosphate, you just take proteins and remove phosphate from it. So this protein here, 4-5, is just a phosphatase. Okay. And the promoter of 4-5 is very simply regulated by two factors, two transcription factors, this 4-4 and 4-2. 4-4 is the phosphate sensitive inducer. So whenever you have low phosphate, okay, you will get this factor binding to the promoter and then starting the production of 4-5, which will remove phosphate from the proteins. Okay? Very simple story. Now, look at this. I can take yeast in culture, very easy, and then deprive the medium of phosphate or adding phosphate. Okay, so you can switch on and off the 4-5 promoter at will. Very, very easy experiment. Okay, plus, minus phosphate. And we see transcription of the gene, minus phosphate, stopping the gene, plus phosphate. Very easy. Okay? Then I can make this experiment, the MNase assay that you saw before. I can make this experiment on this region of the gene. This is transcription starting site, okay? But the gene, this is the promoter region, and this is just an upstream regulator. UAS means upstream activatory sequence. So it's just the upstream enhancer, say. Okay? Good. So let's look at what happens. Okay, this is an MNase experiment. Again, it's made with low concentration, high concentration. And this is 1, 2, 3 are the 3 experimental points. So I don't have any phosphate, okay? Phosphate, and I don't have any 4-4, so no factor, no induction, okay? Then I put 4-4, okay? And LSPO4 there, okay? So now I make the gel. This is a southern blot, as you saw before. Look at all the nucleosomes there. Each bend means that you have longer fragments. Can I go back to the slide before? Here. So when you have positioning, you have bends. Each bend is long as a nucleosome, okay, DNA. So you go there and you see bends, okay. So this is positioned, and when you get phosphate, Okay? So induction by transcription factor, you lose it. This is a scanning of the gel. It's an optical scanning of the gel. So you see the peaks. The peaks are these bands here that you see. Okay? So this is a probe on nucleosome plus 2. Nucleosome plus 2 is something positioned here, you don't see in the scheme. And this is nucleosome 1, that is just sit on the start of the transcription. And you see very, very clearly that you have this kind of situation. So bends clearly here, and then you lose them a little bit. Okay? So this means that actually you have these two situations. Whenever the gene is repressed, so plus phosphorus means repressed, you have positioned nucleosome over it. Okay? And they stay there. When you have situation of induction, so remove phosphate, Fo4 will bind to the sides there, and this will open up the promoter. Okay? So nucleosomes are removed from the promoter, and you have what we call a nucleosome-free region here that actually allows transcription apparatus to start, okay? And you see here that the position is clearly less than the situation before, okay? So this is an assay to see whether in vivo the chromatin is organized in a positioned array or nucleosome or is not. Very good. Now we have to start a very anxious and boring situation that is the least of all the post-translational modification to histones. So the story of accessibility is over. The story of nucleosome position is over for the moment. We will take it back later on. And now we have to discuss the difference in post-translational modification to histones. Oh, there is a long list. This is a kind of catalog, like the, I don't know, enormous list, because there are many, 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 many chemical modifications to histones. And this is just a short list that resumes to you the list. So you can have acetylation, as you know, all. Acetylation is usually what everybody knows, right? Then you have methylation to lysines. Then you have methylation to arginines. Okay. And note that this methylation comes with flavors. You have monomethylation, dimethylation, trimethylation. And when you have in arginines, you can have symmetric or asymmetric dimethylation. It's a kind of specialistic point of view, anyway. And then you have phosphorylation to serines or threonines. Then you may have ubiquitination. Do you know what is ubiquitinase? Imagine to several places. Usually, of course, on the lysines, as always. Sumoylation, that is a kind of ubiquitination. So just different story. And ADP ribosylation. Do you know what did this one? You don't. You do. Okay. Or deamination, okay, that happens usually to arginine that gives citrulline. You know citrulline? Yes. Biochemistry. Okay. And this is proline isomerization. Proline in cis that goes to proline in trans. You remember proline is the amino acid with a ring. So you may have trans and cis configurations, okay? So all these guys, there are modifications that can happen to histone that are found to specialize histones in chromatin, and all of them have a function. So they are not passive, you know, something that happens to histones, but they have function and they are associated with some specific function, okay? Now, this is, again, the structure of the octamer. So from the structure we have removed the DNA, of course, so you just see the histones. And this is the tail. And this is a map of the modification that you see in different position of the tails. Please note that the H3 is the most heavily modified in between all of them. And then you have H4 and the other one, this is H4 and this is H2A and H2B. Okay. So these are the different, this is a code. So hexagon means acetylysin. The small circle is methyl and blah blah blah, and this is a phosphoserine, so you can see the places in which phosphate can be added and whatever. Please just note at the very beginning some of these positions because they are fundamental to the study that we do in the future. And this, please note this K4, this lysine number 4, then please note this K9, lysine number 9, and please note this K here, that is K number 27. They are three key positions in the metabolism of histones, especially for what regards transcription regulation. Okay, so this guy here, K4, can be methylated. This lysine 9 can be either methylated or acetylated. And this same for K27, either methylated or acetylated. What is acetylation, methylation, and whatever? We see in a minute. We see right now. Some biochemistry helps in understanding the function of the stories. So for acetylation means that you have an acetyl residue on the lysine. Can you recognize the lysine here? Please. Any one of you who recognizes the lysine, say yes. Nobody. So lysine is one of the three basic amino acids. Can you tell me the other two ones? A molecular biologist should know all the amino acids, like you know. So, okay. Arginine and the other one? Histidine. Do you agree with me?
Yes.
Okay. Lysine is an amino acid. Can you recognize the basic amino acid structure here? Can you? I ask you for an effort because this is very important. Usually when you are at the exam and I ask you the lysine, nobody knows. This is a very basic thing. You cannot avoid to know that. I mean, as in the amino acid one code letter, this is 20 amino acids, you should know that. It's not difficult. Okay? So anyway, so this is the basic amino acid structure. You have an alpha carbon here that is bound to amino group and to carboxyl group. Do you agree with me? Okay, good. This is amino acid. Okay, then here you have the residue we call, that is what distinguishes the 20 amino acids, okay? And this is a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 carbon structure, okay? So in epsilon, you have an amino group again. Good. Do you agree with me? Okay. So what is the charge of an amino group? It's positive. Amino. Amino plus, okay? Usually stays in solution with as NH3. Plus, okay? Good. When I put an acetyl, what is acetyl? It's acetic acid. What is the structure of acetic acid? Is CH3COOH. So I add it, I make a carboamidic bond here, and the acidic charge completely zeros the charge of the amino. Okay? So you get something that is an amide, and of course there's no charge. No charge. Okay, so the main function of acetylation is to zero the positive charge of a license. Okay, very easy. So this is quite comprehensible. Easy. Then look at the second one. The second one is epsilon N monomethyl lysine. So you see that we just substituted the H, so a hydrogen atom with a CH3 methyl group. Okay. So has the charge changed anyway? No. What can be changed a little bit is the Ka, the constant. The acidic, okay? A little bit, not much, actually, okay? And then you have dimethylation. And then again, the charge is there, no problem. And then you can have also trimethylation, 1, 2, and 3, and the charge is still there, okay? So in this case, you don't change the charge, this is very important, at the physiological pH of the nucleus. This won't change the charge at all. But what changes is the stereochemical property of this. And so this methylated lysine become anchors for different proteins. Okay? So there are proteins that will recognize this methylation and bind to it. Okay? Good. They become docking sites for regulatory proteins. This is phosphoserine. You can recognize the serine here with the OH group is that is phosphorylated. Okay, and then the methyl arginine is a little more complicated because this is arginine. Okay, arginine has this 3 amino and amino groups there. So the methyl can be put on this one. This is monomethylation, or the other one, same, symmetric. And then you can have dimethylation here, and nothing else there, or symmetric methylation, that is methylation of both amino groups here. Okay, so it's a little bit different. So we don't look at all the modifications, but this is the most important. Okay, probably it's not that correct to say most important, the most studied. Okay. So we have a lot of information on this kind of modification, very few on the other ones. Okay, so let's consider this one as a starting point for discussion. Nomenclature. Okay, this is the tail of histone 3, as you can see here. This is the sequence of amino acid. Do you know the one-letter code of amino acid? Can I make interrogation to you? What is A? What is Q? Yeah. Okay. This was good. So you have a nomenclature that is accepted internationally, that is you put the kind of histone here, then the kind of amino acid that is modified. So in this case it's K4, in this case K9, K27. Okay, and then you put modification. So if you have acetylation, you just put H like this. If you have phosphorylation, just put P. Okay, and if you have methylation, you put ME with a number that means how many methyl groups are there. Okay, quite easy. Same with the other ones. Good. Then we can go to the story. There is a story going on that is that this modification can happen to the tails and then have a kind of code. So if you study different parts of the genome, we stop in a minute. We study different parts of the genome in different functional situations, you find different modifications. You find different combinations of modification. Okay, so what this slide tries to tell you is just to, if you look, for example, at I don't know H4, okay, you see that there are many places in which you can have either phosphorylation or methylation or whatever, and these kind of modifications are associated with some of the functional status of chromatin. For example, whenever you have replicating chromatin, You will find these two acetylation there, at position 5 and position 12. Okay? But if you look at genes that are expressed, so not replicating chromatin, but expressed chromatin, you find another kind of acetylation, to 8 and 16. So in some way it means that different functional status are marked by different PTMs. Histone 3, same story. You see, this is just no modification found in silencing genes. When you look at the expressed genes, you usually find methylation of this K. Okay, acetylation of this K. When you look at histone deposition, so during the phase in which histones are mounted to make new novel nucleosome, you find acetylation in this position. Okay, in heterochromatin, you find a methylation here, and blah, blah. Okay, so there is a kind of code for functional status. Okay, of course, we have both single gene studies that are older, from which we derive this kind of idea, and both genome-wide studies. We will discuss genome-wide studies in the next lesson, not today. Okay, and what we know is that some PTMs always go together, some PTMs are mutually exclusive. For example, if you have acetylation to a lysine, you cannot have methylation. That's intuitive. Okay, and also you have that a specific PTM can display an effect on adjacent other positions. Okay, so this is the explanation of what you find in your textbook. This is a picture from your textbook, Bannister and Kuzarides. And you see that when you say this, means that whenever you have, for example, this ubiquitination to this position here of H2B, you always see that methylation of this position and methylation of this position. Probably because the enzymes that carry on this kind of, you know, they go together, so they make the two modifications, okay? Whenever you have K27 methylated in this position, you also have this K119 ubiquitination, so they go together, okay? The combinations that go together. And finally, then we stop. PTMs are not only distributed in a gross way. Of course, you can study small or large pieces of chromosomes, like study, for example, heterochromatic chromatin at the centromeres, big piece. Or you can restrict your analysis to a smaller piece of DNA, like a gene. So again, if you look at the gene, you have promoter, transcription start site, gene body, and regulatory sequences here. And if you study modification over this, you can find a very specific pattern to the genes. Okay, for example, if you look at this graph, this is exactly what I showed before. Okay, so this is exactly the same. Then move to a histogram in which I will graph the level of each of these modifications, okay, measured at different places in the gene locus. Can you follow me? Exactly the same histogram showing the level of each of those modifications through the gene locus. So you can see, for example, if I measure H3K4 methylation, I see that there is a little bit of it on enantiomer. There is a very high level of this modification around the promoter. This is active gene, okay? Active or inducible gene locus. So it's going to be transcribed or prescribed, okay? And then nothing else, okay? In the gene body, no modification of this kind. Then if you look at this, okay, we can jump to the other one. H3K27 acetylated here. Again, enhancer is very good marked with this, and then promoter again, the start again. Nothing else. But if you look at the K36, that is another position that can be methylated in the histone tree, you see that there is nothing at the enhancer, nothing at the promoter, but you have all the gene body that is marked by this modification. Okay? Then you have inactive gene locus. You see that the pattern is completely different. Okay? Methylation to K27. This was acetylation. This is methylation. Remember that you either have methylation or you have acetylation. And you see that the inactive genes, they will have levels of K27Me3 all through the gene. So this is heterochromatic. Stop. Okay? K9, same story. Okay? No other marks. And this is just a bivalent situation that you find. You remember yesterday we talked about undetermined chromatin in the early phase of development. Okay, so if you look at the same gene in the 8th cell stage of the zygote, you see that there is a bivalent status. So you find either active modification. This is active modification and inactive modification. You find both of them. So this is uncertain. It doesn't know what to do when adult. So it has the two modifications there. Okay. Then when you become adult, you will see if you are active or inactive. Okay. Can we stop here for a minute? And we examine briefly the interacting proteins or chromatins. And actually, this again, the list of interacting proteins is so long that we cannot examine in a week, probably. But just the most important categories, just to know what they are. And of course, the first interacting proteins are enzymes that actually introduce modification or reverse modification or finally, the proteins that will bind to specific PTMs. So they have been named with funny names like PTM riders and PTM erasers and PTM breeders. So you will find this kind of names quite often in the papers. So histone modifying enzymes are actually many categories, of course. And you can find HETs that are histone acetyltransferases, HDAT, with our histone deacetylases, HMT, histone methyltransferases, histone demethylases, histone kinases, histone ribosyl transferases, and ubiquitin transferases. Okay, and then you find another category that actually is not directly enzyme in the strict sense. So it doesn't introduce any chemical modification, but is ATP-dependent chaperones that are called collectively ATP-dependent remodeling enzymes. That means that are actually proteins that consuming ATP, they will mobilize nucleosomes, right? Okay. Scientists discovered this kind of ATP remodeling enzyme exactly using that positioning assay that you were seeing before. Whenever you add an ATP remodeling enzyme, you have much more mobilization than without. So they actually work in this way. All the modifications that we know, histones are dynamic and reversible. Actually, there is one modification that is not written here, and we didn't talk about before, that is the cut of the tails, the cutting of the tails. This didn't have much attention before, but I read some recent papers on it. And probably some regulatory function to this removing of the tails has been found. So it may be a good subject for anybody of you who's interested in chromatin dynamics to find this paper for his report. It may be good for that. It's a very novel reartial of a very all subjects that didn't have attention in the past. Anyway, so and this is not reversible. Sorry, of course, when you cut the tail, there is no reversion. Okay. Good. So this is just a list of some of the proteins which make acetylation, for instance. And I don't want you to know all these factors there. Okay, it's just a list. But as usual, from the list, we have something to learn that are not the name. But are the characters, the features. And you see, the major feature that you see here is that all these enzymes have some specificity for position. You see here, for example, HET1, for example, will acetylate position K5 and K12 of histone 4, but not the other positions. We don't have time to go through this kind of things, but as in the same way as you probably studied SH2 domain interaction with phosphotyrosine, right? And you remember that also in this case, the SH2 domain, I cannot talk anymore today, SH2 domain recognized that both the phosphate and some amino acid in the surrounding, this is exactly the same. I mean, these enzymes, they will recognize the lysine, but also the context in which the lysine is. So they choose which of the ones they use. So some of them is quite specific, like these guys that will phosphorylate only one position. Some is middle, two, three positions, and some is quite large, like this CBP P300. Please, this one, you have to memorize this, because this is a protein you always find attached to active enhancers. And this, as you can see, has a quite loose specificity, because it actually acetylates many positions. Okay? Then, if you look at the deacetylases, so the enzymes that remove acetylation, okay, so the other way around, okay, these are usually A-specific. So they remove acetylation from whatever is the position, so they don't look in the context. There is one exception, that is this yeast protein, that is SER2, that actually removes from H4K16 only. Okay? But the other ones are generic. Okay, so you have the mammalian, you have two classes of HDH. They have lost specificity both. Then there is another class that are not dependent on the acetylase, like in sirtuins. This is a kind of funny story, because if you were an enzyme, how do you manage to remove an acetyl group? I mean, if you are an enzyme, what you manage? How do you manage to remove the acetyl?
Oxidation.
No, why?
You can use coenzyme A, coenzyme
no. Edges. Why? I mean, you have lysine. Remember the formula, lysine, amino group, and then you have amide bond. Okay, in between the NH group and the CO group of the acetyl. Okay, this is amide bond. How do you form it? It's the same bond that you have in proteins. Hydrolyze. You add water inside. Okay, this is a condensation. When you form the bond, then you add water in it and you remove it. Simple. I mean, hydrolysis is probably the most trivial enzyme. So they use a substrate that is so common in the cells. No problem. Okay? Really no problem. Actually, remember always that hydrolyzation is also a spontaneous reaction. So it's not really difficult to do it. Well, there is a class of Eastern Day acetylases that works using NAD. So actually, instead of putting water on this bond, it will put adenine nucleotide in it. So it's a kind of very complicated story. But actually, these proteins are sensors of the energy level in a cell. Okay? So they are a different kind of deacetylase. They are sensors. Then, look at the writers for methyl lysine. You have a very long list, okay? It's lysine methyl transferases, okay? So, enzymes that will put a methyl, which is the substrate? Which is the substrate for making a methylation? Biochemistry?
SAM.
Yep. S-adenosine methionine. You remember that? They work with that substrate, okay? S-adenosine methionine, and then they put the methyl group on this lysine, okay? They work with the same mechanism. Fundamentally, there is a very long, enormous list of these methyl transferases. And what you note, please note, what is the difference in between acetyl transferase that you saw before?
The isotope 3 is the only isotope is methylated.
They are absolutely specific. Okay? On the contrary, with the hats that were a little unspecific, they had two or more positions that could be worked with. This is absolute specificity. So there are, we have a long list that take care of H3K9. A long list that care with H3K4, another list that take care of H3K36, and whatever, they have specific. There is only one.
Okay. Yeah. Some of them are redundant.
They are redundant, yeah, this is a good observation. They are redundant. So in the same position of the esters, you have more than one protein taking care of it. And this depends on the context. For example, I make just one example to you because there is the, please note this set 2 protein here, this set 1 protein here. Okay, they both are redundant because set 1 takes care of the K4 and there are a long list of K4 methyltransferases. Set 2 is the same with another couple of proteins taking care of it. Okay, but set 1 and set 2, they are the proteins that travel with the polymerase. Okay, so when you have a, I don't know, okay. So, no, this is not the one, this is, yeah, this is the one, okay. When you have RNA-pol-2, I don't know if you remember how it works. The RNA polymerase has a CTD, as carboxy terminal domain, that is formed by 52 repeats of this sequence. In this sequence, you have two positions, two serines that are key position, S2 and S5. When you have initiation, so the polymerase is set on the promoter and starts transcribing, it has only position S5 phosphorylated. Okay? And when the polymerase is elongating, so it goes through the body of the gene, then it changes because it gets S2 phosphorylation. This position are binders, so they bind to set 1 and set 2 proteins. Okay, so during the elongation, this enzyme travel with the polymerase and put modification on histones. Okay, so this is the reason why there is redundancy. Each of the enzyme has a different function and function a different way. Go back. So we are there. Okay, and this is the list. So, I mean, the take-home message is that they are absolutely specific, and there are redundant enzymes for each position. This is the message. Second, you have erasers, so the enzyme that demethylate different positions, and again, you have a list of those, and they have quite specific, but not that much as in the methyl transferase. So many of them they take care of only one position, but some of them also a couple of positions different. I did one. This symbol JMJ comes from Jumanji, because they call them following the Jumanji story. Since they work in different ways. Anyway, just a curiosity. Good. Then there are other proteins like arginine methyltransferases here, or serine threonine kinases here. And this is all the review from the same guy that you have. And ubiquitinases and proline isomerase, so there is a long list of enzymes and so on. But we don't go through all of them. Now, going through the readers, so proteins that look for modification and can bind modification. They are recruited to histones only when the modification is in place. And we have different categories. The most important ones are chromodomains. Okay, there is a long list of proteins. These are the most studied. Tudor, PhD, this is not a doctor, PhD. MBT, which are chromodomain containing proteins. That means that when you look at them from the structural point of view, all of them contains a part, a domain that is called chromodomain. It's analogy with SH, the domain, is the domain recognized this methyl something. Okay. Or there is a long list of proteins which contains a bromo domain. That is another structural motif, which binds some of the acetylated lysines. Actually, most of the acetylated lysines have only the function to zero the charge of the lysines. Okay, so to reduce interaction with histones, with the DNA. Sorry. But some of them, in some special specific position, are recognized by some protein containing bromodomains. Okay. And finally, the phosphoserines that are recognized by the series of proteins that are called collectively 14-3-3. Don't ask me why. I don't know. Authors called them 14-3-3. I imagine that was a fractionation or something. Okay. So they bind serine. What they do, I mean, why these proteins are recruited to different modification of histones? Because they are actually proteins that have something to do with the structure of global structure of chromatin or with the function, of course. Okay. For example, if you have a modification like you remember the K4 histone 3 K4 methylation that is typical of active promoters, okay, then you probably recruit proteins that will help the machinery of polymerase to work, okay? So it's just a function in the context. Good, and this is another list of readers, just to show you, not to understand everything is there, but just to show you that they show specificity for the position. Okay, again, the readers, they will see with a chromodomain, they will see a specific modification, like methylation of lysine, but also the position, so the context of amino acid in which it is. Okay. Please, of this slide, you have to note fundamentally three proteins here. This is the HP1. We met already this HP1. This is heterochromatin protein 1. That is probably one of the most largely diffused in the nuclei. And it binds, as you can see, K9-3-methylated. Okay. This heterochromatic position. If you make a stain of a cell with an antibody which recognizes trimethylated K9. You will find it all around the periphery. It is heterochromatic. Okay. And the other one that you have to note is BRD2, which is a bromodomain containing two proteins. This is a function in enhancing the transcriptional activity around promoters. And the other, and the final one is I say three and then I lose it. Oh yeah, the TAF stands for Tata Associated Factor 1, and is one of the proteins that is associated to the Tata box. You remember what is the Tata box, right? In the promoters. And so again, this means that this protein, this modification of lysine will help the machinery and the promoters to start transcription. Good. What are the functions of this modification? Of course, one of the most probably studied and understood phenomena is what happens during transcription, of course. So whenever you have a situation of a gene like this one, and you have the RNA pole bound to the promoter, this RNA pole must go through the gene to transcribe a RNA. So try to imagine yourself as a polymerase and found a lot of nucleosome in front of you, and you have to manage, because transcribing something that is wrapped around something is not that easy. And so the first action is to lose the interaction of those nucleosomes with DNA, of course. And so the main story is that when you have transcription factors here, you have co-activators. So you have complexes of enzymes that will acetylate the nucleus of behind to remove them or to lose them. Okay, so this is a classical story. Okay, so actually, this kind of PTMs will influence nucleosome stability. So whenever you have positive charges like this one, if you have unmodified histones and they are quite tight to the DNA, when you acetylate, you remove the tails, okay? So you have binding, and as I told you before, this is just a sum up of the story. When you have acetylation all around, some of this acetylation is just chemical, okay, effect. Some of them will bind bromodomain containing proteins. Okay, when you have methylation, on the contrary, you don't change the charge, of course, but you have binding sites for chromodomain proteins. This is just sum up. We have seen it already. It's horribly boring, this lesson. to me. Anyway, don't care. So another story is that I told you that very often the modifications go together. Okay, so always when you find one modification, you find also the other one. And very often you find the same modification through different nucleosomes. Okay, so we say also that a situation of the chromatin can spread along a tract of chromatin. And this is due to the fact that these erasers and writers and readers and whatever, they often form complexes. So they are not single protein going to the points and making something to the chromatin, but they travel in complexes, as you can see. And if you look at this, you have writer together with reader, together with erasers and whatever. So it means that whenever is the situation, like for example having a single founder modification to one position there, all the other position around will be modified consequently, depending on the kind of complex you have. Okay. Um, Okay, of course, when we have seen this figure that I showed you in the first half of the lesson, here, okay, the question is, how do I know that here I have a high level of modification, low level of modification, whatever? Of course, we study this kind of modification by chromatin immunoprecipitation. Yesterday we talked about immunoprecipitation of chromatin, you remember? Okay. So I can either do, if you remember, chromatin immunoprecipitation then PCR, or immunoprecipitation then sequencing everything. Okay? You remember the scheme? You don't. Okay. Go. I have one. Okay. This is again a scheme of immunoprecipitation. Sorry if I insist, but this is fundamental to understand. So you remember crosslink with formaldehyde? Then SDS to dissolve everything. Sonicate to make fragments, remember? And then immunoprecipitation. So you use a antibody against, in this case, a histone modification specific. Okay, so for example, if you want to study the H3K4 methylation, you will use an antibody which recognizes specifically methylated lysine on position 4. Okay, so this is a nucleosome carrying your PTM, and these are nucleosomes that do not carry your modification. Okay. So you precipitate, you add the antibody will bind to the modified nucleosomes, okay? Then you use Sepharose protein A to take only the fragment containing modification, okay? Deproteinize, so you dissolve all the proteins there, and you get DNA. This DNA will be either single locus, so you make PCR with primer specific to the gene or to the genome location you want to study. You can also use a series of primers to scan a region, okay? Or if you are interested in genome-wide location, you can use, of course, genome-wide. These are already fragments, so no need to fragment anymore, just to make ligation of the adapters on both sides, build a library sequenced by NGS, and find the modification that you have been studying here all through the genome, so genome-wide. Of course, you get a lot of fragments here, millions, and you have to map them, okay? But we will study that in the next lesson. So we studied by this guy, and then we can put the quantity that you find in each position to a graph and find the story. Okay. Now the final two things that I have to tell you about chromosomes and chromatins are: one is concerned with histone isoforms, and the other one about DNA methylation. I imagine that we don't have time to discuss both, so the DNA methylation can probably discuss later on, okay? Just to say there is also this modification. Okay, histone isoform is a long story. It's not in your textbook. Okay, so Kusa Readers and Bannister, they do not discuss about it. You can find just a short description in Wikipedia, I told you. It's good. All right, check it. And histone isoform is a story in the sense that our genome, in general genomes, so many organisms contain different genes, for instance. Not only the classical one that you saw before, but for each of them, H3, H4, H2A, blah, 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 different genes exist that encode for isoforms that are slightly different, not much, but slightly different. For example, you can see that there is a protein that is called SNPA, that is actually a histone 3-like, and it is used only in centromeres. And why is the reason for using this in place of the normal histone in centromere is that this is a protein that has an additional tail that is recognized by the proteins binding to sedatocore. You remember mitosis. You have to separate the chromosomes. So this is the reason why. This is a quite evident function of an isoform, of course. So in that particular region, you exchange this NPA in place of a histone, normal histone, just to have this oncohore to make the sedatocore function. Let's look at the differences in terms of amino acid. Can you see that? It's a little small, too small probably. Okay, this is in the upper part of the slide you see a comparison of the sequence of H3, SEN-PA, that is the one that you saw before, and another variant that is H3.3. I don't know if you can see. It's possible to see a larger one. Okay. I'll just tell you. And if you look at this, there are few changes. If you see the amino acid, there are regions in which there are some changes like this one. Some other regions are completely identical, like this one. In this region here, you see that the sequence is the same in the three proteins. All right? Then the SEN-PA has an extension, okay, an extension here that is not shown, that you have extension over there, okay. These are just the structural, this is alpha helix, alpha helix, blah, blah, okay. So they are slightly different, but please also consider that many of the positions, for example, here this is a K4, you remember, K4 is one of the key positions for modification. And as you can see, SEN-PA is not a K there. There's an arginine in place. But SEN-PA stays only in centromeres. Do centromeres have any gene to be transcribed? No. Okay. So since K4 is a key place to regulate transcription, this is not useful to have in SEN-PA, so this has been completely mutated. It has been mutated, no problem, and this works perfectly. Okay, other positions are conserved. K27 is probably conserved in the two versions there, but not again in the SEN-PA, blah blah. Anyway, some conservation, some not. Okay, if you look at the difference in between H3 and H3.3, actually they are almost the same. Okay, they are very, very conserved one to each other, with a slight difference in stability. Okay, H3.3 is a little less stable if you compare stability of the nucleosome with the DNA as compared to the normal H3. And consequently, you find H3.3 very often in transcribed regions in which the stability of the nucleosome has to be less than the other stories. The same story for H2A. H2A has many other isoforms, like this H2A.Z, macro H2A, H2AX, and BBD, that are found in very specific regions. For example, the sequence, for example, the H2AZ, you find it in enhancer, in the nucleosome that stands at the side of the enhancer, you find this modification. They are exchanged by chaperones, of course. So to exchange a nucleosome that is made with classical H3, H4, H2A, H2B, with any kind of isoform, you need chaperones because you have to disrupt the structure to mount it again with the novel histone. So it's a kind of heavy story, it's not just a phosphorylation or methylation, whatever. Okay, and it usually happens when a region of the genome has to be changed for serious things, for stable things. So it's not that dynamical. Okay. Good. This is probably what we have to know. about it. Yeah, some other information is that, for example, okay, this I told you already, is found at central mass over a stretch of 300 to 500 kb. SNPA is not replaced by protamis. This is also important. It's not replaced by, you know, then during the spermatogenesis you have almost complete replacement of histone by protamines. Okay, they are completely different proteins. Okay, but this SNPA is not removed, so you can find it all through the stages of spermatogenesis, and probably has something to do with the inheritance of this part of the centromere. Okay. H3.3 is it is changed in chromatin also outside the S phase and replaces H3 in reactivated genes. So sometimes you have completely heterochromatic genes that are reactivated for the differentiation of cells, and in those cases you find actually the H3 replaced by H3.3. I mean, there is a review in the bibliography if anybody is interested in this, but I try to make the story short because it's really something that is, let's say, additional to our comprehension. Okay? Then, just to mention, then I leave you, just not to study the methodology. You remember that there is only one modification in our genomes, that is a modification to DNA. Okay, that is this methyl cytosine. I'm sure you know. And this is this modification here. Okay, this is cytosine, and this is 5-methyl cytosine. We have three enzymes that carry this kind of modification. One is DNMT1, which is the ubiquitously expressed, always expressed. While DNMT3A and 3B, they are expressed only in the developmental phases. Okay. And then we have demethylation. Demethylation actually takes the TET enzyme, that is are oxidative enzymes. Actually, they oxidate this methylation to remove it. Okay. Of course, during the embryonal stages, the maximum of removal of methylation is not taken care of by TET enzyme, but it's just a dilution. If you have methylation in the parental DNA, then you divide the cells, then you divide again, and then you divide again, and do not methylate again, you will dilute out the methylation. Okay? So this, in repeated cell division, actually the main mechanism to remove is that one. But we will see that in the context of development later on. Okay. Just let me go back to this. So in the context of heterochromatin versus euchromatin, the methylation is actually very, very, very linked to the heterochromatin. Okay? So if you look through the regions that are silenced, of course the constitutive heterochromatin or inactive chromosome, for example, you know that in females you have 2X chromosomes, and one of those is completely inactivated in all the cells, one of those. And so this inactive chromosome is very heavily hypermethylated all through the story. And you find methylation of CpG very often at the silenced genes, and so on. So the important fact is that methylation to cytosine only occurs when you have a G after that. Okay? So only in sequences of C, G. Okay? Actually, very recently we learned that we have also another sequence that is possibly modified by
methyl transferases, that is this sequence CNG, where N stands for any nucleotide. Okay, but apparently this modification is only limited to the very early undifferentiated stages of development, like zygote cells or whatever, okay, embryonal cells. We will see in next week this story. Okay, so just to remember one thing, that this DNMT1 guy is the one that is involved in maintaining the methylation status of genes. Do you know this mechanism? You don't. Okay, when you have mitosis, okay, you usually maintain the same methylation pattern in the two daughter cells. So the regions that are hypermethylated will be hypermethylated, the regions that are hypomethylated will be hypomethylated, and so on. Huh? And this mechanism is brought about by this DNMT1, because this is a hemimethylation sensitive enzyme. So whenever you have a situation like this one, okay, this is methylation, okay, this is DNA methyl transferases that transfers methyl from the usual same molecule, okay, and will methylate here. But this is, to methylate it, it is required to have the other half helix already methylated, okay? So when, I don't have this light. Okay, no problem. Whenever you have a division, cell division, you have, sorry. It's a pen. A pen. Okay. If you have the two, can you see? You have the two filaments of DNA, okay? CG means that in the other side you have CG also, okay? So if here you have methylation, here you have methylation, all right? Then imagine that the replicative forks go through and will copy the situation, so you will get two hemimethylated DNA. So CG, and this is methylated, this is not, because of course during replication you incorporate normal cytosine. Okay? Same story from the other side. Okay? Now this enzyme, DNMT1, works only when you have methylation, hemimethylation. It will put another methylation here. Okay? If you don't have methylation, like a couple in which there is no methylation, okay, it will not put this the methylation over. Okay, so methylated regions will be replicated, unmethylated regions will be replicated. So the situation is kept the same way. On the other side, these other two enzymes that you saw before, this the MT3A and 3B, they work de novo, so they will put methylation in unmethylated DNA. Just to finish, you have also how they work. I mean, when you have methylated DNA, what happens? There are different models. One is that there are some transcription factors that cannot bind DNA when it's methylated. So you have a block of transcription factor binding. The second way to work is that there are proteins that are called methyl binding protein that recognize this methylation to the DNA and will bring other enzymes to the chromatin. Okay, so this is, you can call it a reader for methylation of DNA, and then you have complexes of other storage. But we will see in a better way next week. Okay, these are all the proteins with a methyl binding domain. There are many of those. And okay, we skip this part. That's it. So just to remember, exercise 4 and the novel paper. Okay, you will find it. These are